Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 192 for April 19th, 2013. Wow! Achates, a posed piston engine design. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Peter DeLorenzo.
John, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing really good.
The only problem about doing the show at this time of day, we might just kind of do it every week this week.
Yeah, and of course, Peter's talking about the live version of the show is going a little bit early because today I've got a, as soon as the show's over, run downtown. I'm going to be the MC for the SAE annual banquet. So that's why we made the shift. And
you get very wet if you run downtown.
I will. It's pouring out there. And the voice you just heard, of course, was Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production Magazine.
John, how are you?
I'm good. I'm
Peter.
Good.
Gary.
Yeah. So lots to talk about. Let's start out with this whole shuffle that's going on at Chrysler and Nissan. Now, Peter, what do you make of this?
Well, I had one of Reed Biglund's acolytes write me saying that Fred Diaz was expendable and had been doing a walk through his job for the last year and blah, blah, blah. Of course, that was one of Reed Biglund's acolytes. So, you know, I think it's no surprise that the executive burnout, thanks to Sergio's reign, is really high. And I think Fred Diaz saw an opportunity and, you know, exited the building. And they promoted Reed Biglund. But, you know, that's a problem with Sergio. That's three years in now?
Yeah, I don't know. What I see is Nissan started the whole chain of events. They really fired Al Castagnetti. I mean, you know, they put out, he left to pursue other interests. That's a euphemism for we fired the guy. Remember, Nissan is one of the very few companies so far this year in the U.S. market that's seen its sales go down. And I'm sure, you know, Bill Krueger, isn't that the guy who runs all of Nissan Americas now?
Sure.
Anyway, I'm sure he's under pressure.
Well, they
from
have that,
Carlos.
That 10% goal. I mean, right. That's the 10% market share. I mean,
in the U.S.
In
right.
the U.S.
Yeah,
well,
that was handed down by Carlos.
Yeah, that's
yes.
part of their Power 88 plan.
It doesn't apply to his personal pet project, the Leaf. Diaz is a cheerleader. You know,
he's been successful at Ram.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the truck market's been going good. They've got a hell of a good pickup.
But he's
right
a cheerleader type, so he's being brought in to get the dealers, you know, light a fire into the dealers.
But what I see is sales are down, boom, Castagnetti showing the door, blang, they bring in Fred Diaz, and now that, you know, starts a whole shuffle going on at Chrysler of all kinds of changes. And then Mark McNabb goes to Nissan as COO of Nissan in the U.S.
Volkswagen.
Excuse me.
Yeah, McNabb basically went to Siberia, which is otherwise known as Maserati. For everyone in the business except for Sergio, who thinks Maserati, they're going to be selling 100,000 Maseratis in the U.S. at any day now. But McNabb was too good to be sitting in that, you know, that limbo of Maserati. So now he's COO at Volkswagen. That's a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, and I think that indicates, you know, Volkswagen is really got a lot of momentum building now. And I think that they want to
keep it going.
Keep it going and even energize it some more. And so you bring a guy like McNabb who's got, you know, experience with Infiniti and experience with Cadillac, experience with Mercedes, going over there. I mean.
And he was wasting his time at Maserati.
So. Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, he basically parked his career there for a while and for a cup of coffee, and now he's moving on. So,
but you're happy that he's going to Volkswagen.
Yeah.
Why so?
I think it's a good move for Volkswagen. It's a good move for him. He's smart. And they need all the hands they can get if they want to keep this pace that they're hell-bent on keeping. So
that's got to put pressure on Jonathan Browning, or no? I mean, Browning, of course, is the CEO of right. Volkswagen of America.
I don't think
I think they're just building a team. I mean, you know, we've seen, you know, from our perspective, seeing them build the PR team, which they've done by, you know, getting people from GM and from Nissan and, you know, organizations like that. And I think, you know, that it's a company that's basically going to say, you know, we're going to be bigger in this market than we've been ever.
Yeah, right? They're committed.
And
real.
And doing fairly well as
they're on track to hit their target.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Yeah.
But, you know, going back to Diaz for a minute, though, I just wonder whether we could read anything into this, you know, vis-a-vis Nissan's intentions in the commercial truck market.
I think we can.
You know, and
i.e. the Titan pickup, the Armada SUV, and the NV commercial vans are complete sales flops.
Right.
So why not get somebody who looks like he's got a pretty good track record in pickups and commercial vehicles?
Mm-hmm. And he also was in charge of Mexico when he was at Chrysler. So that was, you know, because they always have those bizarre world titles over there where, you know, you're in charge of, you know, oranges and...
Baltimore.
Yeah. Which makes us, but, you know, and so
no,
you
that's
say,
a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Because
right. And so you have the Nissan plants
in Mexico. And they're gigantic.
Right. And so, you know, probably not a bad move for him. But, I mean, I always, you know, to your point of being a cheerleader, I mean, it struck me that when you would talk to the man, he was very enthusiastic about what he was doing. I mean, it seemed like there was absolutely no doubt that he was committed to the program.
Well, now he's just committed to a new program.
Yep.
To a new program.
Right. Well, you know, I've said that Nissan's got a lot of unused capacity in trucks and commercial vans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he can get that turned around, he'll be a hero at Nissan.
Right.
They're losing big-time money on those products. If he can even just get them to break even, it's a victory.
You know, and as Ford is you know, expanding the Transit line here, right, and, you know, bringing in the bigger vehicles, I'm sure that Nissan's looking at it and saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, we've got these things. Let's do something with them and, you know, try to perhaps compete in that space some mm-hmm. more.
Gary, you found a particularly silly statement that you thought we should talk about today.
Yeah, I should be accurate when I say what it is. This was, Edmonds was talking about what's going on in the world of hybrids. And this is the quote. Edmunds.com projects that 40 to 50% of new car sales in 2040 will be hybrids.
Huh?
In 2040, I'm going to have a flying car. I don't know about you. And,
right.
You know, and it'll have anti-grav propulsion. I mean, seriously, in 2040,
yeah,
we're gonna be driving hybrid cars. So would we have predicted that, you know, we'd all be carrying around things like this
iPad
in 2013? I mean,
yeah, going out to 2040, that's of course we'll all have forgotten this projection by then.
Well, so, because we don't want to say why we will have forgotten that in 2040.
Yeah. I'm still going to be here, man.
Yeah, but you won't remember.
But I won't remember anything.
Yeah, so
I won't remember that we even had a show called Autoline After
right.
Hours.
And we may not even be able to spell hybrid, but again, another story. But you know, it's just crazy.
We should put out a press release and say they're wrong. It's going to be dilithium crystals and big block V8s.
That's right.
Yeah,
exactly right.
So yeah, I thought that was kind of a crazy projection mm-hmm. for them to make.
Mm-hmm.
So what else do you want to talk about, John?
I don't know. I wrote all these things down in this iPad, and they're not in there. I got all my notes from last week. I don't know what the hell happened.
Well, we had the Ford General Motors announcement of collaborating again on transmissions.
This is their third time?
Second time, isn't it?
I thought it was their third time.
I think it might be their third time, but the first time was very unheralded. So no one knows what that was. It was a transmission, but whether it was a three-speed or... You know,
this is 8 and 9 speed gearboxes.
9 and 10.
Nine and ten. 9 speed front drive, 10 speed rear drive, mm-hmm. I believe, right? Yeah. So what do you make of them getting together again?
Well, I mean, from the standpoint of getting the engineering done at a cost-effective manner and from the standpoint of doing cost-effective parts design, I mean, it's brilliant for those guys to do that because, you know, if we go to the, you know, aforementioned Nissan, let's not forget that Nissan has that deal with Mercedes whereby they're going to be building engines for Mercedes for that'll go into the C-Class in Tennessee. So, you know, those two getting together and doing that. But, you know, what sort of strikes me is unusual in this is that is this just a game of one-upsmanship that, you know, we want to get, you know, more transmissions or more gears in our transmissions than Chrysler has? Is that what it's about? You know, that, you know, damn it, if they're going to have 9, we're going to have 10. And then, you know, somebody's going to come out and say, but you know what? 11's the magic number.
I don't know.
I think we're probably maxing out at about 10. You know, you get into a situation where it just gets too hard to package so many more gears in a transmission without making it bigger. And that's the amazing thing. If you look at the latest generation 7, 8, 9 speeds, they're about the same size as a 6-speed. Incrementally bigger. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to see how they nest gears inside of each other to package this stuff all up. It's really very clever what they're doing. Everybody, not just, you know, GM and Ford.
Right. So, you know, you wonder, is this going to be the start of more collaboration between Ford and General Motors, or is this basically one-off?
They seem to be addicted to collaborating on transmissions only.
You know, because the customer doesn't care.
Right. I think
the customer, you know, engines matter, although
But does the customer care? That's
the
point.
Question,
does
right.
the customer care? So if we look at the powertrain, which basically has been the purview of, you know, individual automakers, you know, we're going to have our own, we're going to do it our own way, you know, and so we all know what a hydromatic is, right? I mean, and that's the General Motors way of doing it. And, you know, we know what a Hemi is, or now we know what an EcoBoost is, right? I mean, and so the question becomes, does it matter? Or is it all a matter? Because, you know, one of the things that they said about this collaboration is that they're going to have the software written differently for the transmissions, so there will be, you know, the characteristic of DNA for each of the companies. So, you know, isn't it possible that they could just have a common engine and just put some software in the engine control unit that would make a Ford a Ford and a Chevy a Chevy? Isn't that what it all comes down to eventually?
Well, John's a big proponent of these guided vehicles, so I guess it won't matter.
Wait till you have your, you know, Playboy den on wheels. Then you're going to turn around and say, you know, McElroy was right. This autonomous stuff is
then
awesome.
I'll be arrested because they'll arrest some old guy with a vehicle full of co-eds or something, and I'll be, you know, vilified and have to do a perp walk and all that. It would be bad.
But, yeah, I mean, look, it's obvious why they're collaborating. You know, if you do an all-new transmission, it's what, about $500 million? $500 million. If all-new transmission, all-new plant, you're looking at $1 billion. So, you know, if you can split that cost in half and the customer doesn't know the difference, mm-hmm. Well, what are you waiting for? Go ahead and do it.
But, again, I mean, it's interesting that culturally they would be able to do that. Now, maybe, you know, to your point that they keep transmissions, maybe it's those guys have it worked out where those guys say, you know what, we'll work together. But other parts of the business, you know, I mean, it astonishes me that they all continue to do their own electronics and HMIs and things like that. I mean, because I don't think any of them do a very good job. So why don't they get together and say, okay, we're going to collaborate on this stuff. Okay, because, you know, we've been making gears for 100 years. We know how to do that. We can do that pretty good. But this other stuff, you know, we're not so good at that. Now, they all claim they're great, but...
Yeah, I don't know. Collaboration can be a real double-edged sword. You know, you can save a lot of money, but when you get two different companies together, two different cultures, two different philosophies how to develop things, you spend the first, you know, I don't know, 6 months just arguing.
Right.
Then you get down to, okay, now we got to make this work. It can really delay a project. So I got to believe that sticking your toe in the water, let's work with somebody on one thing. Let's just pick transmissions. I think helps that process a lot. And the fact that they're coming back and doing it a second time tells me they like the way it went the first time.
Mm-hmm.
They must have thought, yeah, hey, this is working. Let's do it again. Mm-hmm. In fact, let's do it with two transmissions now, rear
right.
and front drive and 9 and 10 speed. So it's I think we're just going to see a whole lot more collaboration up and down this industry. But now the question in my mind is, do you do it like GM did with PSA, Peugeot, Citroën? Do you, you know, take equity in the company, or do you do it like others are doing, like Renault and Mercedes? You know, you get our platform Mercedes and we get your diesel engines, and, you know, do it on a project basis instead of on a business basis. I think that's still to be determined which way is going to be the way the industry goes.
And, you know, this even begs a bigger question in some ways, is if you have these guys collaborating, what is the possibility for a small company to make any dent in the auto industry now, given...
I don't know. Let's get Henrik Fisker on the phone.
I think Peter just answered your question.
Yes. He might be available.
Yeah.
Hey, one other topic to get into that I found fascinating. Mary Nichols was in town this week for the SAE convention. She's the head of the California Air Resources Board. And she attacked the automakers because, and I did not know this was going on, the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers and the Global Automakers Alliance, which essentially those two lobbying groups represent every single car company operating in the U.S. Maybe not the Fiskers and the Teslas, but all the big boys are part of it. They're asking the EPA to stop the California Air Resources Board from mandating electric vehicles. And I find this fascinating because publicly the car companies are all, you know, sunshine and smiles about, oh, aren't electrics great and everybody should buy them and these are a big investment and, yeah, they're not selling well now, but look how they've doubled their sales or quadrupled their sales in the last few years. But behind the scenes...
I've gotten taller since we sat here, by the way.
Yeah.
I just wanted you guys to know.
But, Peter, what do you make of this?
I think it's gloves off against the CARB, and they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. Even though publicly, you know, they're all, like you say, they're touchy-feely and hugging each other and everything's great, but...
Yeah, I mean, I find it somewhat amusing. So yesterday I was in Baltimore where GM launched the new motor manufacturing for the Spark EV. So GM is now the first OEM that's making electric motors for use here in vehicles, and it's sort of ironic that they're actually taking the whole drive system that is being built here and shipping it to Korea, where it's being put in the cars, which are being shipped back to California, essentially.
I mean,
that's where the game is going to be. And then, you know, last week I was in California driving the Fiat 500e, the electric Fiat, which was a blast to drive, by the way. I mean, it really is a great little car.
And, yeah, well, and that's the thing, because people keep accusing me of being anti-EV. I'm not. I love these cars. I'm anti-government mandate, anti-massive subsidies. You know, I'm anti-government picking winners and losers when it comes to technology. To me, it's like, let the market decide.
Right.
But the EVs so far are terrific. I don't fault any of the engineering or any stuff like that. But I've said from the beginning, I just don't see these things selling in the numbers that the so-called experts are projecting we're going to see. But I just find this fascinating about this, the automakers fighting the CARB mandate, because I never heard anything about this. Until Mary Nichols made her speech yesterday here in Detroit, I didn't know this was going on. In fact, it's hard to find any information about this online at all.
Yeah, I heard some grumbling about it earlier in the week that the car company, you know, and to your point, you know, it's all sweetness and light visibly, and then behind it, it's like, you know, let's pull out the daggers. And you know, and maybe part of it is just this concern that, you know, they don't want California telling them what to do.
Well, the real problem is, I think California's mandate, the way it's written, they have to sell something like 60,000 electrics next year. That ain't going to happen. I mean, unless you just start saying, okay, we're going to lose big amounts of money and just give these things away.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to retail at that level. Just not going to happen. And then I think it goes on up to, what, about 1.4 million in 2020, something like that.
I wonder if it'll be in 2040.
That's a great question. Well, on that note, why don't we take a commercial break here? Why don't we get our guest, David Johnson, from Acades Power on the show? So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends from Bridgestone. Well, David Johnson, welcome to Autoline After Hours.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We want to learn about Acades Power because, you know, we've done shows on the OPOC engine from Eco Motors, but you guys also have an opposed piston design, too, and you're the CEO and the president of the company. Just give us a quick thumbnail of what this engine's about, because we'll get into a lot of details, but just to kick the conversation off.
Absolutely. So the founder of our company, so again, thanks for having me on. The founder of our company said, hey, these engines back in the 30s set records for fuel efficiency. And so if we applied all
the... Wait. Okay, now rewind a little bit.
Efficiency.
What opposed piston engines in the 30s?
Yeah, the Junkers Jumo engine was a famous aviation engine. Set records for fuel efficiency, and the founder of the company is a pilot, and he said, man, we should have these engines again, and we should take all the technology the automotive industry has developed for everything else and apply it to these engines, and I bet they'd be fabulous. And so that's what we got started on in 2004. So the basic concept is you put two pistons in one bore, and you get rid of the cylinder head. And it's the same kind of concept that Eco Motors is doing with theirs. We just have a different incarnation of the engine. We just have one cylinder between two cranks, which is the exact same layout that Hugo Junkers had in 1930. And then we've just piled on technology to bring it up to the level of modern engines. And because of its architecture, it's more efficient.
And now you got a lot of engine background, right? You were at Ford, you were at GM. And what got you to Acades?
So when I was at GM, I went abroad. I was in Frankfurt. I was working chief engineer for a couple different diesel engine programs there, 3-liter V6, 1.7-liter inline four-cylinder engine, high volume. And, you know, this was the time in Europe where diesel volume went up. You know why it went up? Because they're great products. They're just great. They're fun to drive. They're quiet. They're smooth. And they get great fuel efficiency. So who doesn't want that? And so I came back from Europe in 2006. And I said, why aren't we doing diesels in North America? Why don't we do that? And you couldn't buy one. I mean, basically, 2006, there was like one. I think it was the Mercedes, right? And we should have them. And so I got a call from this company in California that was not only doing diesel engines, but they were doing the next-gen diesel engines that was going to be the step function improvement. And, you know, if you look at where we've been as an economy with fossil fuels and everything, we need the most efficient engines in the world. And these engines have the potential to do that for us.
So you're talking for passenger car now, not for airplanes.
That's right. So let me just be clear, though. This is a better internal combustion engine, more efficient, less cost, smaller in size, smaller in mass, right? So it has all good features about it. So you would put it basically everywhere if you had the time and the money to do so, right? You do gensets, you do marine applications, you do locomotives, you do passenger cars, you do commercial trucks. If it's better in fuel efficiency, and fuel efficiency matters, why wouldn't you put it everywhere? And so actually that's what we're seeing in our company right now. We're seeing interest in almost every market segment.
And you've got a contract with Tardec, part of the Army.
Exactly. So the military, obviously, is a big user of fuel, and they've got some old technology. And so for us, with our technology, what we're demonstrating or about to demonstrate for them with this project we're doing, it's going to be about a 35 or 40% fuel efficiency improvement for something like a Humvee. It's huge. So think about it. If it's a third, right? Let's just say it's a third. It's easy for math. One out of every three tankers doesn't have to go through the battlefield to get fuel to the field.
And
that's
so what would this be replacing, say it was in a Humvee?
So you start the Humvee has the old Detroit diesel engine, I think it was. You know, it's a 6.5. I mean, it's an old engine, and it's been warmed over and made better, but it's still really old technology. So that's why you can get this huge benefit. If you go into MTVRs and other things, they've got a raft of engines, but most of them old.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, where we typically talk about, and you can read our technical papers, and we get this about 20% fuel efficiency advantage versus modern state-of-the-art engines. But if you go versus something old, like some of these Humvee engines, it's much, much bigger, mm-hmm. really big opportunity.
Now, Acades started on this engine design even before OPOC or Eco Motors got going, right?
Yeah, I think we were started in 2004. I think Eco Motors was formed in 2007 or 8.
Something like that. Because, we had Peter Hofbauer, the designer of the OPOC engine, on somewhere in that time frame.
Right.
But, when he was on the show, I asked him, because he had been at Volkswagen, designed a bunch of engines there. And I said, okay, Peter, let's pretend you're back at Volkswagen, and somebody comes to you with a supposed piston engine design. Would you put it in production? And he sheepishly admitted he would not, because the company has billions invested in the current way of doing things. Isn't that a big hurdle for you to overcome?
So I think it is a big hurdle, but I think his answer was wrong, right? So if you look at what people have to, what the industry has to do right now, so I've got this great chart of the CAFE legislation since 1990 to 2010, and you know what it is. It's a direct flat line for 20 years, and now it goes boop, straight up. So facing that kind of challenge, and now with fuel prices, I mean, in the last 5 years, they've gone from $1.50 a gallon to almost $5 a gallon. So things are changing. And as a result of that, you have to make investments to upgrade your technology. Now, I'll tell you, it's true. The companies have a lot of money invested in technology. But Volkswagen themselves in the last, 6 months, made a press release saying they were going to spend about $85 billion over the next 5 years in bringing out the next line of products. So if you take the engines we have today, and I don't know what Ford spent on EcoBoost or anything else, right, but they're big numbers. You were just talking about a new 10-speed transmission, big numbers. So they're going to do that anyway. Now, the question is, are you going to do that and come out with an engine that's 2 or 3% better, or do you want an engine that's 20% better? And do you want to bring out an engine that costs more, or do you want to bring out an engine that costs less? If you want a big step improvement, and you want an engine that costs less, you better do an opposed piston engine.
And you're talking about an engine that could be built with existing tooling, right?
Right. So this is another thing, right? You were talking a little bit about electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles, and for these vehicles, there's some pretty exotic and new manufacturing technique. You were just down in Baltimore looking at a new motor plant. When was the last time we built a new motor plant? We don't build motor plants, right? So that's new technology. You've got to get new manufacturing processes and figure things out and invest in stuff that you haven't invested in before. Hey, our engines are made of cast iron, cast aluminum, forged steel, machine it, bolt it together, wiring harness sensors. Sounds like a regular manufacturing process, right? So I think...
Isn't that the problem, though?
No, I don't think so.
It sounds like the regular. So if you're some guy who's saying, okay, we've got to get the next development... They're going to say, do we do that, or, we got this clever, unobtainium. We could use that to build stuff with, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, engineers are very averse to the clever unobtainium. Sounds good, but then when you try to get to production, it's not good, right? So, we're doing some studies right now that say you can put this in conventional manufacturing plants. It's just a retooling. And when you're done, you get a much more efficient engine that costs less. So I think the business equation is fairly straightforward. We're just trying to get over the mental hurdle around, really? An all-new engine architecture? Is that what we have to do to get there? And people are studying, maybe we can warm this one up. But in the end analysis, hey, this is a big opportunity and a really good business equation. So I think it works to our favor. And I think you're right. The first impression, so Peter was right, the first thing is we never do that. But then they start to get into the data. And I think the data is what really changes the story and the answer. And we've got reams of it now. So one of the things about our company is that we set to work on solving the problems of opposed piston engines, and there were many. We had companies tell us, that won't work. So we said, we're going to work on solving that problem, whether it's oil control, piston thermal management, combustion. Combustion's a big deal, right? Clean combustion, we meet emission standards. So when we solved those problems, we started talking about it, and that was in 2010. So it's been fun since then, a lot of fun.
Now, I'm sure you've built some of these engines, right?
Absolutely.
But are these like R&D prototypes, or do you have like a production version of the engine?
All prototypes, all R&D, and now we're actually designing engines for customers. So basically with the R&D work, and so we've been running engines in our lab since 2005, right? So we have more than 4,000 test hours on all the different permutations and iterations of the design as we figured out all these challenges and solved them. Right? So now our engines run like day and night. We've got two dyno cells in our building in San Diego, run all the time. But it's still research engines for just kind of learning, right? And we've developed all this technology. Now we're designing engines like we're doing for Tardac, where we'll build a full-up engine for them to their specifications and demonstrate that in a full-up configuration. And this is, I'll say, people talk, it's just a single cylinder. That's what everybody does, right? If you go to GM, they have a lab where they're running a single cylinder, and they're figuring things out. would do the same thing. So, you know, my team consists of people from GM and Ford and CAT and Cummins. And these are the same guys who are doing this. So this is the normal way of doing things. We're just doing it on a post-piston engine.
You know, when I'm thinking of you know, you're mentioning that, you know, it goes back to the 30s, and I'm thinking of those aircraft they were building in the 30s, and they're like, right? And uh-huh. Then you're talking about, you know, doing this thing with Tardec, and I'm yeah. thinking, you know, if I'm rolling around in a tank, probably it's like, right, because I'm not driving on 275, and right. it's not nice and right. smooth and right. things like that. So is there something about an opposed piston engine that might be somewhat rougher than...
Actually, it's the exact opposite.
Really?
So let me just show you what I've got here. I got a couple of pistons. So just, I got to do the motion.
Hold them up so we can get a camera view of this.
So what you've got in a regular engine, I'll take one away, is you've got a piston reciprocating against the cylinder head. And so you've got an imbalanced mass, and you've got to work on that. And so, you know, four-cylinder engines need balance shafts and things like that, and 90-degree V8s, they're okay. In an opposed piston engine, you put two pistons in one bore, and so basically, to a large degree, the forces and these are balancing out each other. And so we've actually got some data we presented downtown at the SAE this week, showing that actually, versus a four-cylinder engine, we have a better balanced engine, right? And then the other thing that you're thinking of is basically combustion noise. Mm-hmm. And combustion noise is a big part of any engine, especially diesel engines. But we now...
yours is a diesel.
We're a diesel. We're running a compression ignition process. I like prefer to say that because we can run other fuels than diesel fuel. But we're running compression ignition. And when you do that, you have higher peak cylinder pressures, and it makes noise. But the industry, all of us together, we know how to solve that problem. And you tailor the pressure rise rate in the cylinder, and you can keep the noise down. And actually, in a opposed piston engine, our combustion chamber is expanding faster because we have two pistons moving away instead of just one piston moving away. And so that helps us to have higher pressures and yet not a higher pressure rise rate, which is what makes the noise.
Okay.
So we got advantages on both balance and noise from the architecture.
And what kind of compression are you running then?
So we run, I'll say, in the same regime, range as conventional diesel engines. So a conventional diesel engine these days is somewhere between 15.5 and 16.5. You know, guys like Mazda are going down on compression ratio. Guys like Cummins are going up on compression ratio. So everybody chooses their own little formula based on what they're trying to do, and we can do that too. So in our labs, we're running 16.5, 17:1 compression ratio.
So could you, you mentioned other fuels. So could you, in effect, build an HCCI engine using gasoline? And so
absolutely. I think, you know, internal combustion engines generically can burn fuels. You just pick and you design for that, right? So we've got conventional engines burn gas, conventional engines burn natural gas. You can work on HCCI. There's lots of things you can do. This is an internal combustion engine. We can do those things too. But we have one advantage that's really important. So when these two pistons come together and create the combustion chamber, looks like this. It's kind of football shape for us. And then we have two injectors that spray into the combustion chamber. So now if you've got two injectors, which is really hard to get on a conventional engine just because of geometry, you've got all those valves and everything in the cylinder head. With two injectors, I can make them two different fuels. Really interesting.
Oh, so you could start on something very volatile and then throttle back to... Once the engine started to something else?
There's all sorts of things you can do when you can get two fuels in the combustion chamber that very few people are doing right now. But you can have dual fuel that are natural gas with a diesel pilot. You can do gasoline and diesel. There's work going on at University of Wisconsin right now with a combustion process called RCCI, reaction controlled compression ignition. There's guys at Delphi doing work on gasoline direct injection compression ignition. So you get all the benefits of compression ignition, and you get the lower emissions of gasoline and that process. So and now we can put two injectors in one cylinder and have all that flexibility.
But you're talking about putting two different fuels in at the same time. I've never heard of that being done before.
Yeah, it wouldn't be exactly the same time, but the exact same combustion event.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some timing that matters.
So this football shape is formed by the shape of the piston heads.
Exactly. The piston crowns come together. They're identical shape, but 180 degrees clocked from each other. And when they come together, so you have to understand in a opposed piston engine, we've got ports at the end of the cylinder, and that's where the intake and exhaust happens. And it happens simultaneously. So you open up the ports, and the exhaust gas comes out one end, and the intake gas comes in the other, and it flows one way through the engine. So we've got the swirling charge motion while we're scavenging the engine. And when the pistons close off the ports, they take that kinetic energy of the air, and they bring it together, and this actually creates a tumble motion. So we've got swirl plus tumble, makes a great mixing environment for combustion.
So are you going to do any racing applications?
So it's interesting. I think it's the Le Mans series or one of the series.
America Le Mans series.
Yeah, has just changed their rules and allows two-stroke diesels. So that's a good idea. I like that idea. I like that idea. You know, when we're at two strokes, we've got a power density advantage. I mean, it absolutely should be. Absolutely. Well, it's not on our own personal to-do list, but it should be.
You can develop it quicker, right, if you race it.
Absolutely. So, you know, I've been reading a little bit about the formation of Cummins back in the 20s. And he did all sorts of racing. It's just great, some of the things that Clessie did back in the 20s to demonstrate his engine. You know, put it in a passenger car and drive across the country.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I moderated a panel at the SAE convention yesterday all about whether racing is really relevant to the auto industry or not. One of the points that came out of the guy that's in charge of the merger of ALMS and, you know, the NASCAR
Jim
guy.
France?
No, it wasn't Jim France. It was
Scott Atherton?
No, it was another Scott. And I had eight people on the panel, and that's why without my crib sheet in front of me, I can't remember off the top of my mind. But the point I was going to make is he pointed out all automakers in the world, with at least two exceptions, approach racing as a marketing opportunity. Mm-hmm. And the budget comes out of marketing, mm-hmm. not when you get to Porsche and Audi. It mm-hmm. comes out of the R&D budget. So there's the key to getting...
Fundamental difference.
Because, you know, marketing budgets are, hey, we won the big race, declare victory, go home, our effort worked. Or, boy, that crapped out, let's just get out of here with our tail between our legs. When it's part of R&D, you project 7, 8, 9, 10 years out in advance, and the budget is consistent. And, you know, look at that e-tron diesel hybrid that Audi's came out with. What a tour de force. Again, it's out of the R&D part of things. So I'm suggesting here, David, is now we just got to convince some automaker to say, hey, let's go racing, and let's do it out of the R&D budget with the Acadie's engine.
Like I said, it's a good idea. Definitely should happen.
I mean, should we take a round of money?
Yeah. Everybody dig deep.
Everybody throw a credit card on the table.
I mean, so is your goal to develop the technology and then license it to a manufacturer so we wouldn't have an Acadie's engine per se, but it would be the technology behind?
Yeah, that's right. So we don't need a manufacturer because, like I said, the manufacturing facilities that make engines today can make this engine in the future. So that's not a good value add for us. And you know, the OEMs have said to us, no, we do the manufacturing. So they want it. That's their value. So this is a perfect division of labor. And you're exactly right. We'll license the technology.
But, you know, EcoMotors had to go to China to get somebody to buy it. Automakers are loath to license anything. In my experience, you know, unless it's like a brand name that they think is really cool and can help sell cars, like I'll just make up a name or make up an example, you know, Bose Sound Systems. Ooh, that's really cool. We'll mm-hmm. license that and we'll license the name and everything. What makes you think you'll be successful in getting any of these car companies to license your engine, no matter how brilliant it is?
So I think there's two key factors. One key factor is we're in a different time now than we have been for the last 30 years. Last 30 years is all about cleaning up the pollutants coming out of engines. The next 30, 40, 50 years is all going to be about how do we save fuel. The second important factor is we're not talking about a small change. We're talking about a big change. It's a really big incremental change in fuel efficiency, you know, 20% fuel efficiency. I mean, that blows away everything else, and it comes with lower per unit manufactured costs. So when you put that together, you're right. I don't think anybody wants to do it, but they need to do it because it's the best option for them. And when they see they're going to control it and they're going to learn about this and, hey, you know, there's enough value created, we'll all be fine. We'll all be fine.
Okay, you've got a development contract from TARDEC.
Right.
What else? What kind of interest are you getting from automakers? Yeah. And when I say automakers, let's just open that up. Heavy-duty truck, bus, you know, the whole nine yards of everybody out there making motor vehicles.
It would be really fun to tell you in great detail. We're around the world, right? So our first paper we presented in India. We've presented in China. We've been to many automakers in Europe. And, of course, in the U.S. So we've covered all the markets, and we see interest everywhere. And it's regionally everywhere as well as market segment everywhere. And, you know, some companies lean forward, and they're like, this is interesting. I want to get involved. And others are like, oh, no. So there is different receptions, but I think that's based on cultures and who's in charge at what point in time. So there's a lot of different dynamics. And then, you know, people change, and then you go back and ask again. So we're seeing interest everywhere, really, and it's really fun.
Just to a point of clarification about the engine that would be made with mm-hmm. this technology. So So instead of having a six-cylinder engine, one might have a three-cylinder engine because you have one.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you'd still scale. I mean, it wouldn't be a, one.
One. That's right. So, in conventional engines, you've got single-cylinder engines in tractors. You've got two-cylinder engines on motorcycles. You've got three-cylinder engines in some vehicles now, the one-liter Ford engine, right? You've got four-cylinder, inline four, V-twin. You've got all these different configurations. Now, we don't do any Vs in OP engines. But we can do one-cylinder, two-cylinder, three-cylinder, four-cylinder, five-cylinder. And because they're balanced, you really can do them in increments of one. You don't have to go in two, four, six, eight. Mm-hmm. So, all those are possible. And you can scale the bore also, of course. So we just, the paper we went through on Monday, downtown Detroit, was about a light-duty application. And for this, we're recommending a two-cylinder, four-piston engine, four injectors, so it replaces an I-4. It's a beautiful engine. We think we'll be able to meet LEV 3 emissions with SCR after treatment. That's about 85% effective. We think we can meet Euro 6 emissions without SCR after treatment, which would be a big deal. Big cost
there.
That is
there. A big deal. Yeah. That is a big deal.
So
you're saying no urea on a diesel engine
for
Euro 6.
Yeah, they're at 0.4.
That ain't easy to do.
So we have this advantage as a two-stroke that actually our peak cylinder pressures are lower. We are a lower NOx engine, and we think it's low enough that we can get away without SCR for Euro 6. So, you talk about the base engine cost being low. Now we're talking about the after-treatment cost being lower.
But what happens at the other end? I mean, so you've got, uh-huh. I mean, so, yeah, we can, very yeah, simple yeah, yeah. here, but it seems to me it's more complicated out here. So you'd have a couple of crankshafts, right?
You've got two crankshafts, and you've got to keep them connected. They have to know where each other is. They're not independent variables. So there's a couple of different ways to connect things, just like you connect the crank to the camshafts. On a regular engine, you've got to have those timed. It's important. That's what we call a timing chain or a timing belt. It's the same thing for us. We need a timing chain or a timing belt or, in heavy-duty engines, they use gears for timing. We do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little different, but you have to keep them connected.
So what does that do to the overall packaging, then,
engine? Good question. So when we look at a six-cylinder engine and we replace it with a three-cylinder post-piston engine, since it's three versus six, we're already getting shorter. So we put a gear train on or a belt drive on, it gets a little longer than just the three cylinders, but not six cylinders long, so it's okay. So on length, actually, in most cases, we're almost always shorter. Yeah, we're all a little taller. So the geometry is a little different, but we've done package studies in heavy trucks, medium trucks, passenger cars. No problem.
So would the cylinders be vertically or horizontally oriented?
How do you want them?
So it doesn't matter.
Well, it does matter when you're doing the engineering. But it doesn't matter to achieve what you want to achieve. So basically, that's a packaging question. So, if you think about conventional engines, Porsche's got boxers. Pistons are horizontal. Subaru's got boxer engines. They're just not facing each other. They're going the wrong way, right? And then you've got inline engines. We had slant sixes. V engines are both there on a slant. Right? So this, in the grand scheme of things, we always think as humans that gravity really matters a lot, but the engine really doesn't care about gravity so much, so long as the oil drains back to the right location. So that's the part you got to worry about when you engineer it. But we've run engines in all configurations, vertically, horizontally, and slanted, no problem.
Don't those pistons go the wrong way because they just want to have one crankshaft?
That's true. Yeah. But then they got all those camshafts and valves. I mean, you take away camshafts, valves, and cylinder heads, you save a lot of cost, on the order of 15 to 20% of the cost of your engine, and you save a lot of parts.
Sure, you'll never blow a head gasket.
And you'll never blow a head gasket, exactly. And I can tell you how many times I worked on projects where the number one problem was the head gasket, making the head gasket durable. It's a big problem point.
Hey, this is a good point to segue into questions from our audience,
Great.
The rapid fire part of the show. So, Ben, let's get going with rapid fire. Let's see. We've got a number of questions that you've addressed already. One was chain or gears. The other one was how are you going to mount the engine like a traditional boxer? Here's a good one from Jack Pearson from Fort Worth, Texas. He wants to know, what's the advantage of your opposed cylinder engine to the one that Eco Motors is going to make for the Chinese? Actually, the Chinese are going to make it. But
right.
Yeah. What's your advantage over Eco Motors?
I think the biggest advantage that we have versus Eco Motors, and it's really important, so we're not opposed cylinder, right? We're just opposed piston. So when you take and make an opposed piston engine into an opposed piston opposed cylinder engine, and you can see where my arms are going, right? It gets really wide or it gets really tall or whichever way you put that. And I'm sure they can put it any way they want to, but they've got this long dimension. And that long dimension really is quite awkward. So I think everybody knows Ecomotors had a project with Navistar, right? And in this project, they had to reduce the stroke to bore ratio to try and make the engine fit in. It went down to 1.6 to 1, and that's a combined two-piston stroke. So you go to 1.6 to 1, then you got to get to 0.8 per piston, and then you've got the ports to close off. Maybe you're 0.6 trapped compression ratio. You really get into an awkward number, and that's not good for efficiency. You want long stroke to bore for a good efficiency.
I got to believe, though, that Ecomotors being out there is actually going to help you guys.
I think
to have two different companies talking about opposed piston engines, I think, sort of validates the approach.
That's correct. And so, you know, in conventional engines, we have long stroke engines and short stroke engines. So there's a place for both engines.
There you go. Steve Nogler from Hockessin, Delaware, wants to know, have you considered running variably running the cranks out of phase with each other for variable compression?
Yes, we have. So this is very interesting because actually the first thing you need to do with an opposed piston engine is you have to have the exhaust ports open first, like we do on a conventional. You got to get the exhaust out first. So the exhaust crank actually leads the intake crank. Was that way with Hugo Junker's engine? It is that way with our engine. And how much it leads can change your performance, just like you want to have variable cam timing. So you can think of our crankshafts give us our port timing. So, yeah, varying that is very useful. And you're right, varies the compression ratio also. So it's very interesting.
Unsprung wants to know, what happens when the load of the transmission is more than the engine output?
Load is more than the output, you stall. That's in every engine, I think.
You know, I thought maybe I just didn't understand the question.
I think it stops. Yeah.
I still don't.
Yeah, you're going up the hill and you don't have enough power to go up. You stop.
Okay, Peter, here's a good one for you.
Do you have high or low expectations for Ron Howard's upcoming movie Rush? You know, all about the Niki Lauda, James Hunt battle. And if it is successful, do you see more coming from Hollywood?
I have high expectations because Ron Howard is really an exceptional talent, exceptional filmmaker. He cares about every project. And I was kind of shocked that he alighted on this. It seemed to come out of the blue. But I don't think it'll trigger more. I actually don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a singular moment in racing history, a dramatic season. But he brings up a good point because Hollywood, you know, they do...
Whatever successful, there will be the sun up.
But I still don't see it for this.
What I find so interesting is Ron Howard's not a racing fan.
No.
He just found this battle between Hunt and Lauda to be a compelling story.
Yeah.
And now he's becoming something of a racing fan, but he didn't start out that way, which I find intriguing.
All the snippets and trailers and behind-the-scenes trailers, it's pretty fascinating.
What was the Sylvester Stallone movie?
Oh, that was Bill...
Driven?
Yeah, about...
Come on, if that didn't make many movies after that, I mean...
then it's never going to happen.
It's never going to happen.
Right. Hey, we got a phone call here. Let's bring that in.
Yes, my name is Clem Zorowski from Delmont, Pennsylvania. In regard to this new engine design you're doing tonight, I have some literature here from the early 60s where McCulloch, the chainsaw people, developed a two-cycle engine using a similar technology. I was wondering if your gentleman there who is involved with this is familiar with that. I even have literature here. I don't think it ever made it to the market, but we were racing go-karts back then, and it was supplied to me by McCulloch. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great question. Are you familiar with this?
So the answer is no, I'm not familiar, but I will tell you, we have, from the founding of the company, we've had a technical advisory board. And one of our technical advisory board members was a guy, Dr. John Beck, famous, who worked for Cummins for 20, 30 years, and he worked at McCulloch. So unfortunately, he's passed away now, but I'm sure at the inception of the company, when he joined the technical advisory board in 2004, he told us all about it. And I'm sure we've learned from it, and it's all in our, you know, the learnings are all in our engine design, but I wasn't personally aware.
Huh.
My go-kart had a Mach 6, McCullough Mach 6.
Oh, yeah, well, Mach was the engine to have on a go-kart, yeah. No question. But I've never heard of some sort of opposed piston
kind of
design that they worked
on. No, I didn't either.
But it makes sense.
Absolutely.
They would have. Peter, I got another one for you. Scotty in Cleveland wants to know, what's your take on Olivier? I'm a genius, just ask me, Francois. His decision to shy away from the tagline, imported from Detroit.
I think it's a smart decision.
Why?
I just think they've overplayed it. And it's human nature of marketers. If they alight on something that's, you know, if it's a real flash, you know, and it, you know, they beat it to death. And I think it's time to walk away from that. Besides, you know, people, it's pretty soon it's going to be Fiat. Not going to be Fiat Chrysler. It's going to be Fiat. So,
you think?
Yeah.
Well,
before 2040?
Well, you know, that's a good point, Gary. I don't know about that.
Gary, I'm going to throw this one to you. Ozzy in Syracuse, New York wants to know. He says, I'm liking the new Cadillacs. ATS, XTS, CTS. He says, but I only keep a car 3 to 4 years, and their depreciation is hard to live with. Should I be looking at Acura, BMW, Audi, or maybe Mercedes instead? He says, I really want to buy American.
If he keeps the car 2-3 years, why isn't he leasing?
Yeah. Then you don't have to worry about depreciation,
yeah.
Do you?
No. And I just got the MKZ today. That seems really nice. Maybe you had a look at that because the depreciation won't be so great because there aren't very many of them, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the way that if you lease, you may see poor depreciation in your lease payment, i.e. a higher payment. But
right.
if the brand, in this case Cadillac, steps in and subvents that lease, i.e. subsidizes it, then it should be no big problem to deal with. So you're right. The answer is leasing.
Yeah. And plus, you know, Gary and I were just talking about it a few weeks ago, the new Cadillacs are.
You got to look at the residual values, though, on the Audi diesels. I bet they're great.
They are.
Diesels
great.
Hold their value great.
Greater than hybrids,
ooh.
In fact. No, you're absolutely
right. And Audi's
right.
Got a great lineup of beautiful cars, so.
Yeah.
Hard to beat.
There you go. Neil Gridley wants to know.
He's not American, though.
Oh, that's true. Oh, I forgot that bit of it.
Well, he wants to buy it. You know, I tell anybody, go out and buy whatever you want.
We're going to have those MKZs out of Flat Rock, right?
Yeah.
Home of the millionth Mustang, as we talked about earlier.
As we did. Okay, back to Neil Gridley's question. He says, seems to me OPOC engine or opposed piston engines would work with Subaru. Has Subaru shown any interest in something like this?
So all of our discussions with customers we have under non-disclosure agreement. You know, you bring a Subaru on here and ask them that, and they won't tell you either. So I can't say. I'd love to say. But I think there's a good point there that, you know, there is an element of the shape of our engine fits like a boxer. Okay, the pistons are going the opposite ways, but it fits like a boxer.
Yeah.
So it's a good place for us.
So that's sort of the point of the car makers, and you know, you won't identify who they are, but is there receptivity to diesel engines?
Depends on which one you're talking about.
Well, we know Audi, but
right,
you know, and then Chevy we had the engineer from the Cruise diesel here a few weeks ago, right?
But the question is,
I just wonder whether the market is interested in diesel engines. You know, this regular people who are going to go out and buy cars.
It's a small sliver of the market right now, just as people interested in electrics is an even smaller sliver of the market, or hybrids or what have you. I mean,
they may be in this room in terms of number, but that's...
As I keep saying, if this Chevy Cruze diesel sells reasonably well, you're going to see a lot more entrants into the market.
Well, you've got a lot of them coming on right now, right? Because you've got the Skyactiv D coming from Mazda. You've got the Cruze coming. You've got the Jeep Grand Cherokee. You've got the 1500. I mean, there's going to be more and more choices. And, you know, where there's a choice, you know, then you get to what's the salesman do when the guy comes in and says, I'm looking for And they answer that question, well, you should try the, well, you do that right now at the Ford dealer, and all you got is a Super Duty. So you need those choices. When you have those choices, I think they'll do well. But, you know, to get that choice, you've got to put the product in the pipeline and do all the engineering, bring it to life.
And you got to market it and all that, make, to your point, Gary, make people aware that it's even out there. But,
right.
You know, when you look at the German brands and the success that they've had with diesels so far, I mean, I think it's largely been word of mouth. I think it's largely somebody gets into a BMW, Mercedes, an Audi, a Volkswagen, and their friend that owns the car tells them, you know, it's a diesel, and they can't believe it. But it's like, what do you mean? It's not quiet. It's not noisy. It's not smoky. It's and you're getting 45 miles to the gallon? What the heck is this about? So I think that's how the word is spread more than the OEMs marketing this thing. What do you think? And give me an answer before 2040.
Well, I mean, there are infrastructure issues you got to worry about. There's still the awful diesel, get it on your shoe and smells forever. I mean, there are those problems with the consumer.
You know, so I have to. I understand what you're saying, and there's real issues there, right? But you know, go to France. They're at 80% mix on diesel, maybe higher right now. And you don't see an uproar going, they've all got to go buy special shoes, right? So these are solvable problems.
They're French, come on.
Yeah, so go to the next country, right?
Yeah, you
go,
Germany.
Germany. I mean, they're 50% diesel. And the people who want the best car, the best drive, they buy the diesel. It's the luxury cars that are selling the best with diesels.
Oh, yeah. No, luxury cars in Europe, it's 80% diesel
exactly.
penetration.
Exactly.
Of course, they still have attendants at the fueling stations.
See. Right. See, so they never get
to... Now, when I lived in Germany, I was pumping it myself.
Well,
I don't know. I maybe went to the wrong station.
That's
I don't know.
Right.
Well, you know, maybe you got to buy a $160,000 S-Class, too. So.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, we got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring that in.
Sorry. I don't have that yet.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Eric Ambrose wants to know, what's the rev range on your engine?
Yeah, like a conventional engine, first of all, it depends on the size. So for a passenger vehicle engine like the one we talked about downtown this week, you know, we're going up to 4,000, 4,500 RPM, maybe 5,000. Depends on exactly how you design it. You might go to aluminum pistons to do that. So there's a lot of design parameters. But, you know, diesel engines have come up in RPM as we've gone to common rail versus where they were before because we can get the combustion and get the fuel in. But they'll never go as high as gasoline engines. Right? It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, because they develop torque so
much. And you don't need to, right.
At a lower RPM. In fact, AAH Guest 551 wants to know, what kind of torque will this engine make?
Yeah, so as a two-stroke and with a long stroke, it's a very torquey engine. So it's going to be fabulous to drive. The other thing, I haven't talked about the air charge system. We've got a supercharger and a turbocharger. Mm-hmm. And so with the supercharger, we have basically instantaneous response. And I know you had Grant Terry on recently. I mean, this is fabulous. We need, I think you mentioned it, we need the supercharger,
right? To scavenge.
And so now that we have it, it's already in our bill of materials. It's already on our engine. We can use it for all sorts of transient control and great response and emissions control. It's fabulous.
Okay, it looks like we got that phone call through now. Ben, let's go to it.
Hey, this is Jonathan out in Old Fan, New Jersey, and just want to say it's a fabulous show. I'm very excited about this new engine. And my question is, when do you think it'll be in a production vehicle that a regular customer could buy? 2017, 2020, 2014, you tell us. Sounds great. Sounds like win-win-win all the way around. I appreciate your enthusiasm and look forward to the answer. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, so it's well before 2040. I think you're actually in the right range there, 2017 to 2020.
This really?
Time when, yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
right around the corner
yeah, it's
in
right
automotive
around the corner.
Terms.
Yeah, so, you know, we're designing right now prototype engines to put in vehicles. So that's the stage where you get going with a production program right after that. So it's lining up. You know, in the world of designing engines, you don't want to do it quickly because our requirements legislatively regarding 100,000-mile emissions warranty, our customer requirements regarding what they expect of the product, are very, very high. So you don't want to stub your toe or otherwise, you know, hurt yourself. So you want to take your time and do it right. And that means it takes about 4 or 5 years from I want it to it's in production.
Do you see it passenger car or light truck first? I mean,
you know, these decisions, the outcome of this ends up being due to our customers.
Right.
It's up to them. But I'll tell you, my personal opinion is, you know, Ford sells about 70% of their Super Duty product with diesel engines. It makes sense to have a diesel engine, the F-150. I think what Chrysler's doing with the 1500 is brilliant, and they're going to kill it. They're actually going to kill it. So I think they'll come down. And if you go to Europe, right?
And when you say kill it, you mean kill in the marketplace.
They'll sell them like crazy. So, you know, I think that's the way it should proceed. I think that's natural. I think that goes with the physics. You know, you get a heavy vehicle, you want the most efficient engine you can get. So I think that all lines up pretty well. And I think if you go in Europe and look at the take rate on diesel, you know, the take rates on diesel are on the biggest luxury, heaviest cars, and the smaller cars.
But that's taxation.
But the difference is, so the tax...
Because they have the displacement taxation as well as the fuel taxation.
I'm not so sure that there is a displacement tax in Europe. We need one of our viewers to get back to us on that. There used to be in France and Italy, there were taxation benefits to getting a diesel, and then there were taxation benefits on the fuel. Diesel's only a little bit cheaper than gasoline these days in most places in Europe. I mean, the tax and the fuel advantage, taxed fuel advantage, is not what it used to be.
Right,
and yet people still go for them.
It's not the differential in fuel price that's driving things in Europe. It's that overall the taxes on both are high, and so you've got a very high fuel price, so you want an efficient engine. When you're paying $10 a gallon for fuel, whether it's gas or diesel, you want an efficient engine.
Well, believe me, before, you know, we shut things down here, we're going to have a whole bunch of answers from the audience out there that does know about that.
Mm-hmm.
But look, good time for us to wrap up here. But David Johnson, thanks so much for coming in. Very interesting, this Achates engine. We're going to have to keep an eye on this.
Yes, I suggest you do, and I'd be glad to come back and give you updates as things progress.
Please do. Please do. Yeah, we definitely want to keep track of that.
Please race it to something and race
it. I know. I think it's a great idea. Yeah, it's been on my mind, but we should go do it.
Mm. There you go. Gary Vasilash, great having you back.
Yeah, Gary.
Yeah.
Good to see you as always.
Peter, good being with you too.
Another show.
And we want to thank everybody out there who has tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.